Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, good morning, Portland, Oregon, in the great Northwest, and welcome all you people who are listening to us on podcast or on freedom970.com, and who check us out during the week on our iTunes and podcast on there. You're listening to Investing Simplified, the longest-running live financial show that has a financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA. And my tip for the week is if you're working with a financial advisor that's not working with other professionals, you need to ask why they are not, because that is how you do checks and balances. And we all know that the tax man does checks and balances on our taxes and our numbers, but you also need to be doing checks and balances on your investment recommendations and what people are planning to do, or what they call legacy planning or estate planning may not be to a real estate planner a real estate plan. So if that's complicated, I don't mean to make it. I want to simplify it. In other words, do your homework. It never hurts to get a second opinion, because there's a lot of opinions out there. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And, you know, having checks and balances on the other side that actually know, like in your situation, you're a financial advisor, but you know estate tax and estate legal issues, and being able to intermix that with what we do, Carl and myself. Which, by the way, good morning, Portland.
Well, yeah, good morning. Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA firm.
Good morning.
And Carl Jessen with the Warren Allen Law
Firm.
Good
morning. I think we got off to a really good start.
Yeah, that's right.
but
Kevin, you bring up a great point, because working with other professionals, yes, I do know about the estate tax law and I know about the taxes, but I know enough to be dangerous. And I always tell people, look, I can advise you a little bit, but when we get down to what you really need to do, you need to be talking to an attorney. You need to be making sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. And you hear that all the time. But when it comes to legal things that are gonna decide how your family's estate is going to be settled or the taxes are going to be paid, you better make sure the person doing it understands all the legal ramifications. And that's where you need to have an attorney. And, you know,
amen. And likewise, the tax consequences. I mean, I think that I'm like you. I'm not a tax lawyer specifically, but I know a fair amount about it in a somewhat limited way, because I don't work with it absolutely every day, and Kevin does. And so, you know, and they're geared towards you know, knowing those things and identifying all of the issues. And that's really what most of us do, is to try to figure out what could be the problems with this, and then go find out the answers. So that's what I think most professionals do, is they know how to find the answer that they need.
Well, you know, that brings up a great point here, because we're the only live show that talks about financial and investing and estate planning. We have a call from Leanne from Portland. Leanne, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
So I was wondering, if you have a small estate and you're the personal representative, do you have to go to court to be appointed the personal representative?
What do you mean by a small estate?
I think it means under $75,000.
Okay, so you're talking about, okay, you got it right. Are you in Oregon or in Washington?
In Oregon.
Okay. Oregon has an interesting small estate process, and what it involves is, you're absolutely right, if you have under $75,000 in personal property, a bank account, you know, a car, other things like that, but usually it's a bank account or something like that, or several, and the total of that personal property is below $75,000, you qualify for a small estate.
Is your residence part of that?
No. And then you can have up to $200,000 in real property. So you could have a house at $180,000 and $74,000 in cash, and you could still do a small estate. The small estate involves preparing an affidavit that goes to the court, and then you have to, and it gets filed. There's a filing fee of about $100, I think. And then what you have to do is you have to mail that copy, a certified copy of that, to basically all of the known creditors and to several agencies in the state of Oregon, mostly having to do with health issues. And that's because if somebody had been on Medicaid and getting public assistance for their medical care or their residential care and stuff like that, there's a possibility that the state may have a claim against that money. And under the small estate process, they require you to do that. So if you're under those two things, $200,000 in real property and $75,000 of personal property, you qualify for you qualify for the small estate process. And it really involves is the filing and mailing of this estate paper, called an affidavit, and then you gather the money. There is a 4-month waiting period, so you shouldn't really distribute any money that you get. So, for example, if it's a bank account and you went down to the bank and you have your small estate affidavit, and they give you the money, well, then the problem is you don't want to spend that money just in case there is some claim, because if you are that person, they call it the claiming successor, or sometimes they call it the affiant or affiant, depending on how you want to pronounce it. That person is the functional equivalent of the personal representative on a regular probate. So if you have that situation, then, you know, unless you're absolutely positively sure that there's no creditors, you don't want to distribute that money until afterwards. But to answer your question specifically, no, you don't have to go to court, but you do have to file papers with the court.
Oh, okay. But you do have to basically have the court appoint you as a representative?
Correct.
And it can't just be what's written in the will. You can't just do it on your own.
Yeah, you could. Some people do. Like I said, there's a company called Stevens Ness, and they have an office kind of kitty corner from the courthouse here in Portland, and they have legal forms, and they have a small affidavit file form, and kind of minimal instructions. So the problem is you have to kind of know what you're doing, but you can do it. I've known people who have done small estates, and
is she possibly asking, can you skip court altogether and just look for creditors yourself and hand out the assets yourself?
Well, not necessarily, because usually the reason that we do a small estate is because there's some account, like a bank account, that's in the decedent's name, and you can't get it because the bank won't give it to you. And they need something, and that's where you usually the small estate comes in more often than not. And so, one thing is you can't file a small estate until at least 30 days after the decedent died. And then there's also a 10-day period between the time that you get your small estate affidavit filed and the time that the bank can give you the money. So you can do it, it may be a little bit daunting, but you know, it's only a couple of bucks to get the forms. Take a look at it, look at the instructions, and see if it works for you. You do have to do some notices and stuff like that, sending certified copies and things. And I haven't actually seen the form for a long, long time. I don't know how extensive the instructions are. That may be something. But you can do it.
All right. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Great question. That, I think, is one of the real values of this show, where you can call in and talk to an attorney or CPA or financial advisor, get free advice, and get some help in doing something that, unfortunately, can happen to, well, it's going to happen to all of us eventually. But it's a great opportunity to do that. You can reach us at 800-990-0750 or 503-417-7626. I'm going to jump right back into a little bit about what we're talking about, but kind of shift gears a little bit. One of the other great things about our show is that you can call in and get an answer for free. You can also email us. And I had an email from one of our longtime listeners. And in fact, Kevin, I know you know this guy. And Carl, I think you know him as well. But we had a client email me a question, and he's on an investment committee. And this is just a caution out there to all you people who serve. You may be serving on a nonprofit's investment committee. You do have a fiduciary responsibility to be prudent in what you're doing. And I commend this person because, you know, if somebody's recommending an investment to your investment committee and there's somebody up there talking to you about the investment, you don't always know the questions to ask. And therein lies the hard part. When you have unprofessional people serving to help a committee who get professional advice and they don't check it out, that's you need to always check it out.
Who's their fiduciary duty to? Is it to the nonprofit organization?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And Carl, you can talk about fiduciary responsibility because I'm sure you're well aware of this as it relates to these kind of things.
Oh, absolutely. You do have, and that really means that you have a duty of reasonable care, and you have a reasonable prudent investment. There's what they call a reasonable and prudent investor rule. And basically, it has to do with, you know, being careful. And part of being careful, if you don't know, is to find out about things before you make decisions on them. And it is important. You have a fiduciary duty really means that you have to look after the best interest of whoever it is that you owe that duty to.
Yeah, we had a case some time ago, and this is, oh my gosh, it's been maybe 10, 12 years ago. In a situation with a lawsuit where a minor child who was injured was getting a large amount of money, and the money needed to be managed for them so they could go to school. And fortunately, now this person is through school, through college, married, and having a very good life. But the fact is, they needed somebody, and we had to present to the court fiduciary reasons why we were recommending the investments we were recommending for the trustee of the trust. And he called me and asked me, he said, put together some things we can take into court. We did. They did accept it, and it worked out just fine. But we went in with long-term track records. And the reason I bring this up, this person happened to send me a thing, and I actually went on Yahoo Finance, and I sent him back an email, and I checked out this investment. This particular investment that they're recommending for the investment committee is an investment that has not been around all that long. It's only been around since 2008. So, yes, it was around during the time when the market took a big hit. However, that's the whole problem. This particular fund came out at about $20 a share. Right now, it's at $19.08. So it's never gotten back from the 8th of, or excuse me, from May 11th, 2008, it's never got back to that high. So if you were having this money being managed in your investment committee's investment, the results would not be very positive over a tremendous growth in the market. Your portfolio would actually have been worth less than it was the 7 years before. So I would not recommend that particular investment for this investment committee. They could put maybe part of the funds in, but you better be willing to take the risk of if there's a hit, you're going to have a pretty big decline. And in this case, it took 6 years to catch up, and it still hasn't caught up. So I personally wouldn't want to take that fiduciary responsibility in a deal like this and say, yeah, put your money in that account. That's not one I would recommend. But I wanted to run it by because we did have a listener, and we tried to answer your questions. I did send him a full email telling him all the answers. But I think it's real important. There's a lot of people on the air, a lot of people offering certain services and things that they do. And I always say to everybody, look, it never hurts to get a second opinion. If somebody's offering you a free analysis of your investment portfolio, a free of your expenses and what's your portfolio doing, that's fine as long as they look at the long-term picture of it. If they're not looking at the long-term picture of it, if they just take a one-year picture or a two-year picture and they're not looking back 10 years, that's not a fair assumption of what you're investing in. You really need to look at it. And I got to tell you, this week, you know, we like to talk about people we talked to this week. And I met another person this past week. And I sat down, and they came in, and they did an analysis, and I looked at it. And I'm probably one of the few financial advisors that tell people, you know what, you've got a really good portfolio. You really don't need to change. If they really don't, I'm not going to try to tell. And I told him, and he said, well, you know, the other guy I went to, who's on the radio, he told me I need to change all this stuff. And I said, of course, that's how he gets paid. It's called commissions. You know, what you really want to look at is it the yield to you or is it to the yield to the advisor who's selling you? And I told the guy, I said, look, when I go back and I do the 10-year study on your portfolio and I analyzed it back 10 years, I said, you know what? Your portfolio is probably in the top 3 to 5%. Why would I change that? I mean, I'm good, but I ain't that good. Nobody is. Nobody bats 1,000. When somebody tells you they're batting 1,000, they aren't telling you the truth. They're not investing your money. Now, they may be sticking it into a annuity, but the reality of the annuities, and again, I say this all the time, indexed annuities, by law, are not an investment. They are not an investment. And I hear guys on the radio all the time, and I don't know why the state lets them get away with it. They're actually stating a falsehood. It's not true. It's not an investment. Regulated by the Securities Exchange Commission states, and the United States Congress has stated, they are not an investment vehicle. Their return has been about 3.1% over the last 14 years. Granted, you can't lose any money if you don't have any guaranteed income benefits on it. If you have a guaranteed income benefit that charges anywhere from 95 basis points to 1.5%, if your portfolio makes no money, and they say this all the time on the radio, your portfolio makes no money, you don't lose any money. It's not true. If you have an income rider and it's charging 1.5% and you didn't make any money in your investment portfolio, where does that income benefit come from? It comes from your cash. I sit down with clients all the time who tell me, I got this product, man. I'll never lose money. I've got a guaranteed 8% income benefit. Yeah, you do. That income benefit, you have to pay for. It is not free. There is no free lunch. If somebody's telling you you're getting the free lunch, hang on to your wallet because the bill's probably coming to you. You just don't see it.
So Chuck, for the average investor, I'm guessing they probably take a look at their balance at the beginning of the year. They compare it with their balance at the end of the year to come up with how much did I make this year? And am I doing good or am I doing bad? You know, they probably make an adjustment for distributions they might have taken out of their brokerage account. Is that a good way to look at your rate of return, or is there a better way to really find out?
You need to look at two things, Kevin. Number one is, what is the purpose of that investment? We have, you know, for simplicity here, we have long-term investments that are designed for growth. Those are going to be way more volatile. And what I mean by volatile, and this is where you need to know your own investment risk, if you can accept a 10 to 20% dip and then a 10 to 20% up, and if you're all right with that and you can live with that, that's what we call growth, long-term investments. Those can be all around, you know, depending. Then we have, you know, where maybe the annuity fits in, where you're buying guaranteed income benefit. That you're not looking for a return on. You're looking for that lifetime income check. You're looking for that pension check, basically. But that's not an investment. That's money you just, it's like Social Security. You put it in there, you're going to draw out a monthly check. If you don't look at it any other way, you're just fooling yourself. Then you have investments, which would be short term. And short term, we have two areas in there. One of them is 5 years or longer, and one of them is short term for liquid cash. Liquid cash is something like a money market account where you're not going to make much interest, but you always have the money available. And then the five-year investment is something where you don't want to take a high risk on it, and it might be up or down. But if it's in your portfolio in the right place, even though it may have a bad year, you got to look at the long-term results. And I'll give an example here. And let's say you have a very conservative managed portfolio for the last 15 years has returned an 8% net return. Now, that doesn't mean it's 8% every single year. Last year, it could have been down 1.2%. Does that mean you would cash it out? Well, let's see. Would you want to move that to the S&P that in the month of January was down 3.1 in a month? That's a little more volatility. That could be 36% decline over a year. Do you really want that risk? So you got to look at the risk and the return as it relates to it. And as we get older, the older we get, the less risky we want. We can take a little volatility in our portfolio, maybe 3 or 4% decline. But what you don't want to see and what is the kiss of death, if you're 5 to 10 years from retirement or you're in retirement and you have a 30 or 40% decline and you're going to have a 4 to 5 year catch up, you cannot afford that. You can't. Now, at your age, yeah, you should be more aggressive. As Carl and I,
I was going to say Chuck wasn't pointing at me at that time.
Yeah. I'm talking about Kevin. But Carl and I are going to be way more conservative in our portfolios. We're not going to take the risk that Kevin's going to take. I mean, Kevin, you know, talk about a risk taker. This guy runs the hood to coast. I mean, talk about risk. Wow, all those crazy drivers out there.
This is true.
That is a risk. But that's what you take the risk to get the reward. Long term, you can do it. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Carl's comments. You're listening to Investing Simplified. Look, if you got a question, pick up the phone, give us a call like Leanne did. She had a great question, 503-417-7626, toll free 800-990-0750. Maybe you listen to one of those other financial shows and you're hearing all this stuff they're saying, and yet they'll never answer a question live on the air. We will. Ask us. Give me a call. Ask me the question. I'll answer it for you. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. It is time for Carl's comments. And I think the first thing I'd like to say is this is sort of a risk analysis. And that I'm directing this partly to Leanne, who was kind enough to call us earlier. And that is, anytime you do it yourself, you know, there's an old adage about, you know, lawyer being his own client. And the problem that you run into is that on like small estates or anything, you can certainly do that. And I've seen people do lots of things. I've seen people try their own cases, which I wouldn't recommend, but that are non-lawyers. But anytime you do that, you run the risk that you miss something that's important. Because there are some, you know, little rules and stuff that apply to those things, and that's like using forms off the internet. You know, sometimes they're fine, but sometimes they're not, and that's the problem. You may not know, and not because you're not smart enough, but just because you might not know because you're not trained in the area or you haven't had the enough information. So in any event, one of the things you should consider doing is if you want to try to do that, you can always ask for advice in the middle of it if you get into trouble. Nonetheless, a lot of people do that, and sometimes it can save a person a substantial amount of money. But there is a caveat to all of that. Well, the comments today that I have on is also another kind of risk analysis, and that has to do with a very common situation, and this is sort of practical advice, I guess you might say, and that is the situation where you have a relative, usually a child or a grandchild or, you know, nephew or somebody like that, who is thinking about, and an elderly person, an elderly parent or, you know, grandparent or whoever, is they're talking about moving in. The child's moving in to help out grandma or mom or dad, and they're gonna stay there, and they're gonna be kind of a caregiver, and they're gonna, you know, basically make life easier for grandma. That's the theory. But the problem is sometimes that's not really what happens. And so I wanted to touch base on a couple of things that you might want to consider before you really do that sort of thing, because it can go the wrong way. First of all, I think it's very important to say, okay, why are they moving in? Are they really moving in to help grandma, or are they a chronic unemployed kind of financially challenged, judgment challenged person, and they just need a place to stay. You're basically keeping them from homeless, and all of a sudden they've now, you know, become a caregiver. If that's kind of the reason, that's maybe not a good reason. That can give rise to all sorts of mischief. Secondly, do they expect to be compensated? Or are they doing that, again, if they're doing that because they're just going to help you out, or are they really doing it because they expect you to give them the house when you die? That's a very common, that seems to happen, and more often than not, they'll wait until the person dies and they say, oh, well, grandma told me that they were going to give me the house. It's a very, very common kind of situation. So you need to establish the rules and the agreement when you first start out and have it fairly clear if you can. And if they're going to be compensated, if they're not going to be paid, then you know, that's one thing. But if they're going to be paid, how are they going to be paid? How much are they going to be paid? Are you going to, you know, how are you going to handle the tax situation for these people if you're actually paying them money? And to what extent does free rent constitute income to them? And all sorts of questions that come up that are very important. And are they going to be, you know, are you going to be making any kind of report to the IRS to cover this compensation? At what rate are they going to be compensated? And there's a whole lot of issues with live-in people who are going to be compensated that often are just overlooked. If it's a purely gratuitous deal and they're just doing it because they don't expect anything from grandma, and all they expect is to be able to provide her with a safe and secure environment, and they're capable of doing it, well, then great, that's fine. I think so. Then nobody, you know, gets any income or anything like that, really. It's more of they're just living with grandma. But that's where you have to kind of take a look at this stuff. And the one thing you don't want to have is someone who after they become disgruntled, this is a very common situation. They moved in and they've been there a couple of years, and now all of a sudden they believe that grandma was going to give them the house. Maybe grandma even said that because she's no longer competent. She doesn't get the house because there's no will or anything that says that she gets the house. So all of a sudden there's this big claim in probate for, you know, $50,000 worth of compensation for taking care of grandma for the last, you know, 24 months. That's a big problem because it's a proof problem. And again, it's very, very important to think exactly, you know, how is this going to work for them? So the other thing I think is important is, how do the other siblings or the other family members think about this arrangement? You know, are they really good with this? Because if there are a lot of dissent, that's going to be a problem too. Finally, are they bringing anybody with them? Are they bringing their teenage kid? Are they bringing their mastiff dog? Are they bringing their biker boyfriend? Who's coming in with this deal? And that kind of thing. And if they're supposed to provide some medical care, do they have any skill at doing that? Do they know anything about providing the care that you really need? If they don't, then maybe that's not such a good idea. So there are a lot of things to think about, and I would suggest that you look at those things, have a family meeting, quite frankly, get everybody together who has anything to do with anything and say, is this really a good idea? And then kind of think about these things. Are they going to be compensated? You know, what are their expectations? What are your expectations? If they're going to be compensated, how's that going to work? What happens if it doesn't work out? Are you prepared to kick them out? Because that can be a real problem and an expensive and difficult and heart-wrenching problem when you have a family member and you gotta get rid of them. I'm not saying it's not a good idea, because sometimes it's a great idea, but sometimes it works very badly. And you need to really be objective about your own personal circumstance and say, no, this really wouldn't work, or yes, this would really work, because it's based on the right kind of motivations and the people have the right skills and the right attitude. So that's my comment for today.
Okay, we're going to come right back with the tax investigator. You're listening to Investing Simplified. And if you haven't checked out yet, make sure you go to pfgwm.com. Do your Social Security webinar right there at the comfort of your house. You can go right on my website and do a seminar evaluation. And then if you want to do a personalized maximization, you can sign up for that, and we offer it for free of charge. But you can look at it right on in the comfort of your home. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over 3 decades, and its 9 attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified here, and we're glad you're up on this Saturday morning. Hopefully the coffee's hot and your radio is turned up, well, at least for Carl's section. That's always worth turning it up. But today we're going to briefly take a look at some of the happenings on the current filing front. As you've maybe seen on the evening news or heard on the radio and stuff, there's some early hiccups in the e-filing of tax returns this year.
Say it isn't so.
It is so. It is so, unfortunately.
I think did Oracle fix their system for them this year, or
I don't know about that. Earlier this week, a number of states had reported a significant uptick in fraudulent tax returns being filed. It wasn't on the federal level, it was on the state level. What's interesting is when we e-file a return, the federal return goes first and the state return is piggybacked on that. The federal return has to pass before the state return gets sent. And so if the federal return gets rejected or there's any issue, then it gets bumped back. And so that's an additional check. But But what's been happening is it appears that some taxpayer information has been compromised one way or another, and ne'er-do-gooders came into possession of said information and have filed state returns directly with the state through third-party tax software, TurboTax, that is out on the market. And so they haven't filed a federal return, and your federal return goes through, but your state return gets rejected because a return has already been filed under your information. And I'm assuming there's a refund due on this return, and they're not paying a balance due for you.
You know, maybe I'm watching too much television and seeing that there's too many high-tech things available for chasing down the bad guys. But can't the government go back and check the IP addresses on these things that come in that get emailed into the government where they're filing fraudulent income tax returns?
Don't look at me. I'm not the tech guy. I would think so.
I would think so. Doesn't the government have a system where they go after these guys and maybe put them in jail? And
you know, one of the things I think that often happens, though, is that there's a huge volume and they move around. But the other thing is, a lot of times they're like in Ukraine or something. You know, I mean, that's where the IP address is. It's shifted around through.
Wouldn't that be the first indication of a tax return if you're living in Portland, Oregon, and you're filing a tax return and the check's being sent to Ukraine?
But I don't know that you would know that by how it got filed electronically. I'm not sure that it would show.
Sending the money to?
Well, see, that's the thing is. It's the states are pretty tight about what sort of security they have in the IRS, too. So they don't want people knowing, what the front gate looks like so they can get around it easier. But they have a number of checks and balances and stuff. And that's why this was discovered. And they have tracked it back to the point where, hey, we realize it's not other third-party tax software. It's actually TurboTax that is being used here. And so like H&R Block system and some other ones, there hasn't been a compromise, and they're not sure. You know, Intuit with TurboTax has looked into this, and they said, "Well, we've had some pretty big companies come in and tell us that our particular tax system is not compromised." So where it's happening, they're not sure. I reading between the lines, the statement that they made says it was kind of an interesting statement. They said that it was. It didn't result from a security breach of its systems. The company believes that the information used to file the fraudulent return was obtained from other sources outside the tax preparation process. Mm. So somehow I think Intuit got breached in another way, but maybe not their exact tax processing system. So that's just my speculation. I have no basis for that, but it seemed funny that they particularly said it wasn't the tax system, but everybody knows that this Intuit was the tool
they were using
to
take advantage of it.
You know, it's interesting how there are so many ways of scamming these days, and yet they still, you know, these electronic things are beyond most of us. They certainly are beyond me, and you try to protect yourself as best you know how, which is, you know, limited, and there are a lot of these people that are extremely clever, but then they still use the old-fashioned kind of intimidation things. There's this scam about you probably heard this, that the people get a call and a person with a strange accent, you know, says that they're with the IRS and they're threatening them with, you know, they're going to come and get them and put them in jail unless they write them a check or put their, you know, credit card or whatever it is in their hands in the next 5 minutes. And they're very insistent and very persistent.
And they actually leave a number to call.
They leave a number to call, and I'm sure it's a couple of guys sitting around in a room, and they're convicted felons and stuff or whatever, and they don't own anything, and they're probably not too worried about, you know, getting caught. But in any event, they do this. But for those of you, the IRS never calls you and says, "Give me money." And unless you've gotten about a dozen letters in advance, and you know exactly what it is they're talking about, they don't work that way.
And when they get serious, you'll get a registered letter from them.
Yeah, and you know, if you,
you will get it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they telegraph what they're going to do. You know, nobody gets surprised by the IRS.
They
coming
don't
in
email you.
Yeah, no,
they
no.
don't call you. Yeah.
So so if you
fake.
Get one of those, just you know, I suggest the. You know, the Gracie Allen approach is like, you don't sound like you're from here. You know, you don't sound like an IRS guy to me. Mm-hmm. You know, anyway, well, I just leave them alone and shut. You know, turn the phone off. You know, hang up, and you can complain to. There's a number that you can get for IRS has a number to call. They want to know about these things, under certain circumstances, I suppose you could call, you know, local law enforcement and all that kind of stuff. But don't give them any information. That's the main thing.
That's exactly right. Well, that phone scam is fairly believable. They've got it down. I heard a recording of one of them, and it sounds pretty official. And they've got the foreign accent knocked out, so that's gone. So it's you know, and it's persistent. But just know, unless you are specifically working with an auditor, and that's the key word, you're being audited. I mean, that's the nature of them looking at your return. You're not going to have correspondence with the IRS personally unless they're auditing you.
I've actually got those calls, and I one time I was home and I got one of those calls from a guy from, it sounded like he's from India or someplace, and I said, fine, send me a registered letter. If I get the registered mail, then I know you're legit. Mm-hmm. But talking to you on the phone, I haven't got the time, and I hung up on him. But I said, send me a registered letter. If it's legit, give me a registered letter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I never did get one, so I guess it's not legit.
Yep, that's right. Plus, they'd have to have gone through me first, Chuck. So
that's correct.
Yes,
that's right.
So finishing up on the TurboTax thing, Intuit does have a number out there for people that have been affected by this, and they're going to provide identity protection services and free credit monitoring. So it lets me know they know that they had a breach somewhere. So anyway, just to get that off out there. To wrap it up, then, I want to talk a little bit about a fairly new phenomenon. Maybe it's pretty well done here by our millennials and stuff. We're not talking, you know, if I were to bring up income averaging or reinvesting capital gains, the younger crowd is like, just goes right over their head. Got no clue what those is, but those who are listening, chances are, you know what those things are.
Yeah.
Well, those things are out the door. They've been long gone. And so this is a new phenomenon, of course, not on the tax side of things, but crowdfunding. Now, crowdfunding, I'm not talking about what Artful Dodger did for Fagin with Oliver Twist, you know, none of that type of stuff. But this is online solicitation for gifts, for donations, fundraising for your new business startup, that type of a thing. And there are a number of crowdfunding websites, such as Kickstarter, GoFundMe, Indiegogo. Hadn't heard of that one until I was working on this. YouCaring, YouFunding. So those are some websites. And basically, there's any number of reasons to set one of these up. Maybe you have a sick friend that has upcoming cancer treatments that aren't being covered, and you want to garner support and help that person. So you go and you set up an account. People donate, and say you've raised $50,000. Well, the hidden surprise here is you're probably going to get a 1099 on that $50,000 in your name if you were the administrator, if you will.
If you didn't set it up as a tax-qualified charity?
Well, you have to be a charity to do that, and that means actually get an application through with the IRS.
So if you're just trying to do something to
exactly.
help a friend and put it in your name, you're going to be screwed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And specifically, well, I won't go into some charity rules there and stuff, but when you give a donation, not a donation, when you give a gift specifically to somebody, that because it's specific to somebody, that makes it not tax deductible. But we won't go into all the little nuances of that. So you get this 1099-K for $50,000. What do you do with that? I mean, say you've got, I mean...
Call Kevin.
and that's right. And you get the 1099-K when you have over $20,000 in a year and over 200 transactions. That's going to generate significant activity enough for the processing company, such as PayPal or Amazon Payments, who's the underlying processor of these payments, to generate that 1099-K. They don't know what you're doing. They don't know if you're a business. They don't know if you're a charity. They don't know if you're, you know, trying to garner fresh capital for a patent that you think is pretty cool. So they don't know any of that. They just know you met the parameters for getting a 1099-K. And so there's some misinformation out on the internet on this, and there's some fear of getting that 1099-K. Oh my goodness, this is income. Just take a step back and look at the nature of what you did. And I would say there's probably four different categories that you could have done something. You could be garnering gifts for somebody. You could be in a legitimate charity and you're garnering donations. You could actually be selling a advanced sales for a product or a service that you are promoting that people like. If they donate so much, you know, quote, donate so much, then they'll get an advanced copy of the product at whatever price that they paid and stuff. So that would be a business sale. And then the last thing I can think of would be more along the lines of venture capital, where you're trying to garner investments from people to become an investor in your idea or your product. And so really the underlying business activity is going to determine how this, quote, income 1099 is going to be taxed.
You know, Kevin, I've heard a little bit about some of this, and one of the concerns I have from being licensed through the Securities and Exchange Commission is, don't you run into the problem of an unregistered security in getting money, people to invest in your company? Because that sounds like, to me, the Gray Bar Hotel could be coming your way.
Chuck, that's out of the scope of this conversation. Please keep advanced topics like that to your own segment.
We'll be right back with Chuck on securities fraud.
Yeah. Isn't that a potential problem?
I would think so. And that's, you know, as commerce changes and, bitcoins, new regulation, things like this have to be addressed and looked at. And that's exactly right for the venture capital side of things.
You better have a really good corporate attorney who understands tax ramifications of raising unregistered securities if you're gonna breach into that area.
You know, it's very interesting because it's a lot like, I was just thinking – the initial thing that you talked about was, you know, somebody gets hurt or injured or sick and you're trying to raise some money for them so that they can, you know, defray the cost of the care. And a lot of times you used to hear those like on TV or whatever, and they've established a bank account at some bank and you just deposit there. I'm guessing then that the bank gives you a 1099 if you establish the account.
I do wonder about that. I've always wondered, when you donate to a bank in the name of somebody for a cause, what the nature of that is. If you get a tax deduction, if the bank is actually a charitable wing that they're setting this up under, I'm curious on that.
Well, now that Kevin's opened up a whole big box of worms here, if you've got a question about this, give us a call at 503-417-7626 or toll free 800-990. We'll be right back with the Knowledge Trust. Unless, Kevin, you got a few more tax tidbits we can get to. So, okay, we'll be right back with Investing Simplified. Just the way
you say goodnight to me. Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
But, you know.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had a $1 million.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. And just to wrap up our prior topic, if you got one of those 1099s and you were just helping somebody out, all you got to do is put that on a Schedule C on your tax return as income, and then as other expense, indicate put an expense for the exact same amount, indicate that it was gift purposes, that type of a thing, and that should zero it out on your tax return, and you should be good to go without any adverse tax effects. But probably want to just chat with somebody a little further on that, make sure you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's.
Yeah, absolutely. I think anytime you you're talking about doing things like that, you've got to be very, very careful to make sure you run it past your CPA or your attorney to make sure what you're doing is legal. Because,
so much is done online nowadays. And the world kind of runs online in many ways. And for most of us, we're not computer people. I mean, most people are not. And I guess to me, one of the frightening things is that the only people who really understands how all that stuff work are 16. And,
or 10.
Yeah, you know, it's a frightening kind of thing for those of us who, can remember the original Commodore 64.
Well, it's kind of interesting, but the fastest growing segment on the internet is 65 and above. So seniors now, because of AMAC and AARP and a lot of the senior organizations, have really put an emphasis on seniors to get involved on the computer. I think, and plus the fact that banks and many of our investment companies now are starting to charge a fee for getting mailing your statements, because the statements are so thick and the cost of the postage, that they're offering free service if you do an email statement. And so I think we're going to see more and more of that from companies and whatever organization you're dealing with, the banks. I mean, they're all offering now things on doing your banking online, saving having to go into the brick-and-mortar facility and do your banking. And a lot of people are doing it.
Well, and for those of us like lawyers that, in my case, that, we used to do things with a quill pen, is really, the right now, for example, Multnomah County has a mandatory electronic filing for all cases, and so we don't file papers anymore. Generally, there are a few exceptions, but you have to file it, and we get notices, and all of our trial notices and all that stuff are all emailed, and so it's a whole new world for us out there, and there's some really wonderful things about that. I think that there's some room for some really, great mischief too, though. So that's,
I have a number of clients around the nation in different states, and often we will never exchange a piece of paper to do their tax return. And we use a secure portal, as secure as that can be. Nothing is perfect. It's just like there's no such thing as a earthquake-proof bridge. As my structural engineer brother-in-law told me, he says they're earthquake resistant. They're not earthquake proof. So, anyway, we use a secure portal to transfer sensitive documents, and we can do a very good tax return via email these days.
Yeah, you really do have to be careful. And speaking about planning your retirement and looking in the future, I do want to again emphasize that we have a Social Security webinar on my website at pfgwm.com. And Kevin, how does somebody get a hold of you if they want to get a hold of you?
We're at 503-666-5569 and on the web at baker-colson.com.
Okay, and Carl?
503-255-8795, and we're at warrenallen.com.
Well, we still got a few minutes, but I wanted to get that out so you'd know how to get a hold of them. Plus, you can go on my website, and we have a link to each of them as well. And you go on their website and email them. And, we always tell people there's no foolish question when it comes to your money or your investments or your taxes. And we really mean that. You need to ask questions. And if you're working with professionals, you need to ask questions about the ramifications, the long and the short-term ramifications of those investments and what it means to your estate or to your investment portfolio or your taxation. And I hear a lot of things that I consider misstatements all the time. And I, all I'm saying is, you know, it's buyer beware. You want to make sure you check it out, because when you sign the paperwork and you sign, normally the paperwork's all designed to protect the guy who's ever selling you whatever they're selling you. That would be true in a real estate contract or any contract. But you need to make sure what you're doing is working, and it never hurts to get a second opinion. If you want to sit down in the comfort of your home, you ought to pick up a copy of Investing Simplified. It's available at Amazon. Also have them available at our office. But pick it up, read it. I got a very nice call from a gentleman who's a longtime listener who actually got a copy of the book, and he said after reading the book, he was really happy about the fact that we had 9 other contributing experts, which 2 of them are in the room right here with me, and he was going to use this as a reference guide as he was doing his planning. And I think that's what we really wanted it to be, is an educational book where people can use it, learning about their investments, but learn about taxes, learn about how to work with a CPA, how to work with their attorney, how to do long-term care, various other things that we have in the book. It's just a great source. So if you're not taking advantage of it, you need to take a look at it. Also, I got to say, I've got a section in there on how to hire your financial advisor. And I got to tell you, there's some financial advisors here in town that are not too happy with me about what I put in here. But I really don't care, because it is what it is. And if you take a look at it and you ask them the 8 questions you should be asking your advisor, you're going to find out some things. I had a person call me from the radio show and said, gee, I did what you said, and I checked out the guy I'm working with, and he's got complaints all over the place, you know, and he's been fined. And I didn't know that, and he never disclosed that to me when I sat down with him. Well, buyer beware. We've been saying it on the show for a long time. You can go to FINRA Check and check out anybody. You can check me out. You can go to the state of Oregon. You can check me out. You can go to the state of Washington, check me out. And if you're not checking out your advisor, maybe you should. Thank you very much for listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be right back next week with a lot of talk. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
We do Investing Simplified. Financial Group Wealth Management. Price Financial Group Wealth Management.